Chris and Cosby.
The group dedicated to fight crime.
They're gonna chase it down.
From the street perspective, Curtis Sliwa.
All of it.
Please welcome Rita Cosby.
There's a lot of heat on the president.
The headlines, the issues, the people.
America!
From New York to D.C. to your neighborhood.
The Red Berets are helping the cities in fear.
Curtis Sliwa.
Founder and president of the Guardian Angels, Curtis Sliwa.
Rita Cosby.
Rita, that was an explosive interview.
Live, local, on it. Curtis and Cosby.
Curtis Sliwa.
Rita Cosby.
Curtis
Cosby.
77 WABC.
Oh, no, we're gonna rock down to Electric Avenue. And then we'll take it higher. Oh, we're gonna rock down to Electric Avenue. And then we'll take it higher.
7 minutes after the hour of 12. As we are high atop Madison Square Garden, these great facilities provided for us in order to do this broadcast to all of you by NJDiet.com. And governors on both sides of the Hudson River, Rita. First, Andrew Evil Eyes Cuomo, King Cuomo II, the son of Mario Faccia Brota Cuomo, King Cuomo I, as he campaigns for a third term, has continued to insist that he wants Indian Point, the nuclear reactor in Buchanan in Westchester County, right in the shadow of the Tappan Zee Bridge, closed, padlocked, no more energy to be developed and distributed. In New York City alone, we get a third of our energy supply from Indian Point, the nuclear power plant, and it supplies energy for Westchester and the Mid-Hudson Valley.
Well, that's the thing, too, Curtis, that people have been talking about this, politicians in particular, for years. But yet, the alternatives, I don't think, are necessarily realistic. It's a big, big campaign push, and I think Cuomo's got a lot more to worry about right now in terms of, is America,
well,
was it ever great, other than Indian Point?
He keeps talking about solar and wind that will replace fossil fuels within 20 years, but what about for the here and now, as the globe is getting warmer, the summers are getting hotter, and it'll just mean you have to burn more fossil fuel to replace the incredible amount of energy that is created by Indian Point. And then think across the Hudson River, the oldest nuclear power plant in all of America is closing ahead of schedule. That's Oyster Creek. And Governor Murphy has said, yes, absolutely. But we don't want any windmill farms off the Jersey Shore.
Right. So they can't have it both ways. It's like, come on. You know, we can't have this. And that's why this has to be thought out. I think so much of this is political. And it sounds good when you're coming under heat, especially in Cuomo's case, an election year with the election right around the corner. But you have to play on the alternative because it's unrealistic.
Think of it. Both of these governors spew a lot of hot air. And their hot air alone could turn the turbines.
Yeah, exactly. That's the plan.
That will be turned off at both Oyster Creek in New Jersey and Indian Point. But ladies and gentlemen, both governors are in solidarity. They want to close the nuclear power plants. They say, don't worry about it. We'll get plenty of energy from solar and wind farms, but just don't put it off of the Long Island Sound or put it off of the Jersey Shore. Our number is 1-800-848-WABC. That's 1-800-848-9222. But it harkens me back to the two blackouts that occurred in Summers, in which you couldn't have imagined any more a different response to a calamity of that extent. Thinking back to 1977, it was Wednesday, July 13th. At about 8:30, I remember I was behind the counter at Mickey D's on East Fordham and Webster managing the night shift when the lights went out and all chaos just consumed the city for days on end.
Con Ed says the blackout was triggered when severe lightning knocked out transmission lines that connected Indian Point, the state's main power grid, to the city. With those lines down and with demand for power unusually high because of a heat wave, other generating plants, unable to handle the load, began cutting themselves off. It took only minutes before it was all over. New York had been disconnected from the nation's electric system.
And then here was a resident from Bed-Stuy, Do or Die, talking about the mayhem.
I think it's really disgusting, you know? It makes you really want to throw up when you look at what's happened. And we got to live here. There's no place for us to go.
And then two old-time cops busting their shoes in the 77 precinct when the call went out, all hands on deck, all hands on deck.
We're all in uniform. We're all sitting around. And the door flies open. And this guy comes in. What the F is going on? They're walking away with my store. The CO hears this, and he comes out. And he says, who are you? He says, I'm the commanding officer. You're the commanding officer? Well, command something. He says, they're walking away with Broadway. So we take streets to get up to Broadway. There was thousands of people in the street. Carrying chairs, carrying refrigerators, carrying TVs. How are we going to arrest all these people?
And that was the Broadway that runs under the J Street, the J Line of the subway system, which cuts through Williamsburg, Bushwick, Bed-Stuy, and then takes you right to Broadway Junction, East New York.
By the way, when I hear that, it sounded like a young Curtis Lee was talking. They were grabbing this. They were, you know, I covered L.A. riots. And that's like when I hear the way they're talking, Curtis, it's like grabbing this, grabbing the TV, that put it on the air, doing this.
Excuse me, in the words of Maxine Waters, you mean the L.A. insurrection.
Oh, that's right. That's right. No, the L.A. incident. The incident.
That's right. The insurrection. Anyway, here was another old-time cop talking about what it was like when the lights went off in 1977.
So I says, let's get the cars over here. Take what we can take and the rest of it. You know, the hell with it. We're putting two and three guys in the back seat. We're putting televisions in the trunks. We're putting televisions in the back seat on their laps. Sometimes we're putting two guys in the trunk and closing the trunk and transporting him to the precinct.
I love that story because you can just vision it and just how chaotic that they literally put guys in the trunk.
That's right, arresting them. Oh, because the looting was right out in the open. And at the time, Abe Beame, a mayor of no consequence, would not order shoot to kill if necessary to stop the rioting. So it just went on unattended for like 2 days.
By the way, speaking of sort of like a chaotic moment, you think about it, at 1 o'clock, we're going to have Ed Mullins, who's head of the Sergeants Benevolent Union here in New York City, because he wrote a scathing letter saying that, like, crooks are basically getting away with, you know, berating cops. We talked about what happened at the 40th precinct and also the 28th precinct, Curtis. And, you know, just sort of shows of the chaos that if you let chaos reign, he is writing to the commissioner and saying, you got to clamp down. He's going to be with us at 1 o'clock. But it sort of almost describes what we were just hearing in 1977.
A lot of that happened during the blackout of 77, the disrespect towards the cops, which eventually led to the election of Rudy Giuliani, who gave this city a badly needed colonic and turn the cops loose. Meantime, let's move the dial up a few years.
Sounds like we need an Ambien or something.
2003. The lights went off at about 4 in the afternoon. It was August 14th. And a lot of people just assume, oh, no, the lights go off in the city of New York. There's going to be all kinds of pillaging going on. There's going to be people burning down buildings because the lights, they not only went off, it wasn't temporary, they stayed off.
I'm trying to find a gas station that's open. Around my area, there's still no gas. All the gas stations are still closed, no electric.
And then here was Brian Williams not telling a story, but actually telling the truth.
Tonight we are dealing with the approach of darkness, but so far in New York, the opposite of panic in the streets. In fact, New Yorkers doing what they do like no one else in the world, getting along in a crisis. You have seen all kinds of examples so far today of people helping total strangers out of a jam. Tonight they're helping each other out of the city.
And they were singing Kumbaya.
Yeah,
people were respectful to one another.
You know, it's amazing, Curtis, too, looking back, being it's the anniversary, of course, of the blackout, it's interesting to see just the contrast. It's unbelievable. And I remember, I was young during 77. I remember some of the reports and so forth about it. But obviously, 2003, I remember, obviously New York City, big sky rise. You're like, okay, all the, elevators were shut down. We had to find alternate place to stay. And I was at Fox News at the time. And I remember because I was doing a lot of intelligence coverage and a lot of other things. And of course, the first reaction in 2003 was, oh my gosh, is this a cyber attack on our grid? because it came, you know, 2 years after 9/11. So yeah. New York City is going, oh my gosh. So there was this sigh of huge relief when it turned out obviously to be, you know, electrical issues and so many other things. And also the tone, you're right. Like people weren't panicking. You know, at first they were like, oh, trying to make sense of it. But people were coming together, like as New Yorkers do, as we did after 9/11.
Think of it.
You know?
Think of it. As you mentioned, the thought was in 2003, a possible cyber attack. We know the Russians and the Red Chinese have that capability. They're always probing. They're always probing the grid now, testing the grid to see if they can invade the computer system and cause this kind of chaos. But more likely, it'll come from just a depletion of energy, because I don't think a lot of people realize energy is all poured into, like, 1 gallon, and then the energy is sucked out of the gallon by everyone who's using it. It's not like you just have New York energy, New Jersey energy. Right. It's all poured into this 1 gallon, and everyone's sucking out of it simultaneously.
And under a heat wave, too. You're dealing with a lot of, like, people, air, there's a lot more electrical that puts pressure on the grid.
Nuclear out of it at Indian Point and Oyster Creek. And then what are you going to do to replace it? Our number is 1-800-848-WABC. It's Patrick in New Jersey. Welcome to Curtis and Rita Cosby here on WABC. Patrick.
Hi, Patrick.
Hey, guys. I grew up in North Jersey. Grew up there, looked to buy a house. The taxes were ridiculous. So I found the beautiful town of Winoka Harbor. It's part of Lacey Township where the Oyster Creek Power Plant's located.
Yep, I know exactly where that is. Yep.
My taxes right now, I have a beautiful house on the water. My taxes right now are about $5,700 a year. When they close this plant, the amount of money that we save in taxes, I mean, it's going to kill the town. It's a lot of, you know, hardworking, blue-collar people who have nice houses. It's just going to bury them. And the fishing and everything down there, the warm water that the plant generates, it's a big fishing area.
Hey, Patrick, let me ask you, though, on the other side, haven't you been worried about living near Oyster Creek? There's always this sort of fear of, like, not living near something like that.
No, I mean, it's clean. They come, they test the water, everything.
What happened there?
Oh, I think we lost him there. I'm not sure. We lost Patrick.
You lost him on the grid?
Yeah, we lost him. Maybe we had a blackout with Patrick.
What happened there?
I think Oyster Creek took over.
Oh my God.
Did you hear what I said? I said, what do you think happened? Maybe they said, oh, you haven't had a problem with us yet. You're going to have a problem now.
The poor guy Patrick just had his electricity shut down.
Yeah, by Oyster Creek.
Governor Murphy, it's supposed to take place in October. But no, this gives you an idea of
there
things to come. There could be blackouts for any number of reasons. Let's think positively, meaning positively that it's not a cyber attack.
You mean that Patrick could have a nice glow to his hair because
right,
he lives
right
near Oyster Creek?
But I mean, think of it. You close these nuclear power plants. You say that the replacement is going to be wind farms that they don't want off the Jersey Shore. They don't want off Long Island Sound. So where are you going to put them? And then you talk about solar energy, which is a great idea, but it still has to be developed. So you end up burning more fossil fuel now. That means coal plants. That means heating oil plants. It's sort of like, well, wait a second. I thought you don't want to warm the globe.
Right. I know. It's like they're trying to have it sort of both ways. And that's why I think not even having a realistic plan as a backup is just so ridiculous. And it's just, it's all playing politics.
It gives us a chance to pause, knowing that there were two blackouts that many of us lived one.
And I'm curious what our listeners, too, what you went through. What did you go through? And what do you remember from 2003? Where were you? Because we also remember these moments in time, Curtis, where things are so dramatic. And I remember, you know, it was like a scene out of I Am Legend. You know, I feel like, you know, remember that scene with Will Smith and it's like, you know, desolate, like nobody was around. And I remember, like, I finally got a car. I stayed at a friend's house because we couldn't get into our place. And I remember it was like there was no store open and it was almost like when I covered Hurricane Katrina, I went down to New Orleans, Curtis. It was so desolate. And when we finally found a store that was open, it was everybody was forming on the store.
In 1977, it wasn't desolate. Thousands of people were in the street looting and robbing and just marauding. Our number is 1-800-848-WABC. That's 1-800-848-9222. 12:26, as we talk about the two blackouts that afflicted us in 77, followed by riots, and in 2003 with Kumbaya, because Cuomo and Murphy are closing nuclear power plants in both states and have no energy to replace it. Let's go if we can. First up in the queue, it's Neil calling from Queens. Welcome to Curtis and Rita Cosby here on WABC. Neil.
Yeah, hi. I'm a retired detective. I worked out of Williamsburg in 1977 during the blackouts.
Oh, wow.
We had caught people sitting in a sneaker store trying on the sneakers.
Wow.
Another one broke into a clothing store. Flashlight looking in the mirror because he just robbed a suit and had it on and was looking at it.
Oh, he had it on. How did the suit look? Was it pretty good?
Well, I don't know. It was dark out. There was no light.
Oh, and my gosh.
We caught them carrying a bathtub across Broadway. I mean, they broke into a plumbing supply. It was just chaotic. When it was all done, we had to have the fire department come into the cells and hose down the cells because they ran out of toilet paper.
Oh, my. Now, hey, Neil, I have a question. If it happened today, and let's pray, obviously, it doesn't, how do you think New York City would respond in this climate? Do you think we'd see the same thing, or what do you think we'd say?
I think you'd see the same thing, only, you know, like at that time, it was chaotic. I went to work in civilian clothes with a helmet on. I've gone.
Oops, hey, we're losing Neil. We're losing Neil, but he said that he thinks it would be crazy. Okay. I like the scene of the bathtub.
What, Indian Point go down?
Indian Point knows we're talking about them.
We lost our caller from New Jersey. Did Oyster Creek go down? We lose Neil?
We're consistent, at least.
Oh, man. What's
consistent.
Going on here? Let's go to Joe, who's calling from New Jersey. Welcome to Curtis and Rita Cosby here on WABC. Giuseppe.
Hi, Joe.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Good, good. What do you remember from the blackouts?
It's funny, actually. I heard the last guy was a detective. I'm actually a New York City fireman. But
awesome.
Back in 03, I was just a kid. I was 13 years old. I remember it was a Thursday because that Monday was the start of football two-a-days in high school. It was going to be my first time. And then the lights went out. And the next day, we planned on going to Great Adventure. So we woke up the 15th. Some of the power grid was back on, some wasn't. And we decided to go down to Great Adventure anyway and just give it a shot. We weren't doing anything. And what do you know it? They were up and running, and nobody came out because they thought the power was out, and we had the whole place to ourselves all day long.
Oh, my God, what a fun thing.
We rode every ride 3 times. It was unbelievable. I'll never forget it.
So, so even the gangbangers stayed away from Six Flags then?
Yeah, that's a rarity.
I was with my dad and a neighbor and his dad.
Now, weren't you worried, though, like, say, like on the Ferris wheel at the top if suddenly the power went out? Were you worried about like that, like key moment suddenly going back?
You know, looking back, I didn't even think about that. We took a chance. Once we showed up and saw that they were running, there was no looking.
How fun! I love that. That's a great story.
Well, you know what they say about Six Flags now, Great Adventure, is that they fly their flags and the gangbangers
come in
flying their flags.
Oh no, the different flags.
Oh
right.
Yeah, let's go to Alden calling from Newburgh, the Camden on the Hudson. Welcome to WABC, Alden.
Hi, Alden.
Hello. How are you?
Good. What do you remember, Alden?
Well, I was working in White Plains, New York in 1962, I believe it was, or three, and they had a blackout that blacked out the whole Northeast. And I don't remember any violence. But the reason I call is that we need, in this country, we need dependable electricity. And if you look outside at night, the sun is never shining. So what do you do for solar power at night? And we're going to have, in 20 years maybe, this country's going to have 100 million electric cars. How do you power these cars? You're going to have to burn coal and gas?
Well, that's why it is such a poor planned, you know, idea. I'm with you, Alden. I'm totally with you. Let's go to Arnold from Wayne, New Jersey. Arnold, you're here with Curtis and Cosby. Go ahead, Arnold.
Yes, I was in a unique position during that blackout 77. I was working in the Soundview area for Con Edison, believe it or not. And my job was collecting from delinquent accounts.
Oh, my God.
So they sent me out to cut the electricity for the people that had no electricity.
So they wanted you to cut electricity for people who in the blackout had no electricity.
That's an unforgiving job.
That was some genius there, your boss at Con Edison.
I was going to say, I'm sure Arnold was a very popular guy, too, I'm sure.
They sent us out in the morning, and then they called us back to come back to the office because it doesn't make no sense cutting lights that are out already.
No, so actually our previous caller, Arnold, mentioned the other blackout I had failed to mention was during John Lindsay's years. That occurred, I believe it was in the winter in the 60s.
Yeah, I was going to say you're going back.
Right, so we've had 3 blackouts, and now the threat of more to come because both of our Doomkopf governors, want to take out of line the nuclear power plants that supply so much energy that we consume, especially in these hotter summers. Oyster Creek in New Jersey and Indian Point in New York.
Don't say the word Oyster Creek, because then our callers won't be able to get through.
That happened twice.
I know.
But anyway, right now, let's get our news headlines and update.
A thunder of jets in an open sky, a streak of gray and a cheerful... A loop, a whirl, and a vertical climb, and once again, you'll know it's time for the adventures of... Rocky and Bullwinkle.
We all grew up with Rocky J. Squirrel. The whole concept of squirrels. Well, it's come full cycle for me at the age of 64. Because in the last week, on two separate occasions, I've been in Canarsie to check on the house left behind by my mom and dad, still up for sale. So I'm sort of the caretaker. And I had come right from a meeting about the L train closing at Holy Family School.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's about 8 o'clock at night, and I noticed some strange things that I had seen previously, a week before, on my visit to the house to check up on it, and it became very disconcerting because I remember sitting there when there was a huge tree in the front lawn, and we'd watch the squirrels dancing and prancing around this huge tree. They'd be collecting the acorns, you know, right before the fall. And then they'd be burying the acorns, forget where they buried the acorns. And like a year or two later, all of a sudden, a little sapling would start growing where there had been no tree before. So the squirrels were happy. They had their tree. They collected their nuts, their acorns, and they were out of our head. Never were a problem at the house. Then all of a sudden, with one of the recent storms...
Yep.
The tree came down, had to be uprooted, so there was no tree. And so all of a sudden, I noticed each and every time I go there, there was like an invasion of squirrels into the house, and they worked their way inside, you know, where normally you would have had the insulation separating right from the drywall and then outside the aluminum siding.
They find their cracks.
Oh, you could hear them walking through, and then all of a sudden I said, wow, I'm at war here. And so I'm thinking of all the things that I remember people used to do in Canarsie, because there were always squirrels there collecting nuts.
What did they do in Canarsie?
Oh, plastic owls. They would mount on poles. You know, it's like as if you had chopped off an owl's head and you had mounted on a pole, and that would keep them away.
What, they did, it would scare them,
yeah,
you know, like a scarecrow?
Yeah, and then they had electronic machines with strange noises, sort of like the sound of Yoko Ono singing.
That'll do it.
And then all kinds of physical barriers you'd set up. So I did the easiest.
Yeah, what did you do?
I had set up a plastic hefty trash bag barrier.
Uh-huh.
And the squirrels just gnawed their way through.
Of course.
So now I've had to declare all-out war against Rocket J. Squirrel and his other squirrel pals, many of them coming over from the cemetery, the Canarsie Cemetery. So they're like, man, they're like by the dozens.
Well, that's the thing. They come out of nowhere. And you know, in Greenwich, Connecticut, I'll tell you, I remember, you know, we had a big backyard. And I don't think there was a day where I didn't see a squirrel. And one of the funniest days of my life, I've talked about our crazy dog. We had a crazy dog, Rocco, that was fighting with everybody in the neighborhood. And we set up a skating rink in the backyard. And Rocco, suddenly out of nowhere, where 10 squirrels came out. It was probably maybe even more. Suddenly this like army of squirrels came out. Rocco was our crazy German Shepherd, was determined to get the squirrels, as animals always do. The cats chase the squirrels or the dogs chase the squirrels. So I set up a skating rink in the backyard. Rocco was literally sliding on the ice, chasing the squirrels. The squirrels were chasing. They were chasing each other on this fake ice rink that I created in the backyard for probably about 10 minutes. It was great entertainment.
Well, I'm appealing to everyone out there. What should I do? Because I'm not 4-H boy. You know, I didn't grow up. I didn't grow up in the suburbs or the rural areas.
You needed my mother, who all animals, great and small, she was there for.
Well, I need some advice. Our number is 1-800-848-WABC to rid myself of this squirrel menace attacking the house of my mom and dad.
Well, I think we have a squirrel expert, don't we? Too.
Yeah. 1-800-848-9222. So we reach out to Long Island. To the town of Matzah Pizza, a.k.a. Massapequa, and its most infamous graduate.
I thought we were getting the squirreliest person we knew. That's what I thought this segment was about.
No, it's Brian Mangalucci, our producer and board operator, squirrel expert,
squirrelologist.
So, Brian, please share with me some of the strategies of what you've seen in the past that have worked out there.
Well, Curtis, I don't know why you think I grew up in Massapequa. I don't know where that kite came from.
It sounds good.
It sounds good. Matzo pizza.
Colucci, right? Colucci.
Yo-yo.
Matzo pizza.
By the way, I'm going to get a squirrel. Yo-yo.
Okay, fine. We'll go with it.
Okay.
So, about 2-3 years ago, my neighbor across the street from me had a squirrel problem. Mm. And it was about probably February, January, around there. It was getting cold. Mm. And a squirrel got into his attic. And he didn't know it at the time. He just heard something. Maybe it was just the roof. Maybe it was the trees. Mm. But it turned out it was a squirrel in his attic. And when he go to work, the squirrel come down, like he owned the place. Like he paid the mortgage, like he owned the place.
Right.
Prancing around the house, you know, going on the sofa, trying to gnaw at the screen to get out, going through the pantry, going through the cabinets in the kitchen. He couldn't get him. So he went in to get traps. He went to Home Depot and got traps, set them. The thing was smart. He put peanut butter in it, didn't take. He was just going around like he owned the place, tormenting him for months. And also, he's going through Valentine's Day chocolates, just having a field day.
Oh, that's low. When you go for Valentine's chocolate, now it's
right?
war.
And
it's
just
now
going around like tormenting him.
Right.
He came home from lunch one day, and he sees the squirrel perched up, sunbathing in the bay window. Torment him. Sees him.
No.
Yeah.
Did he have a bathing
like,
suit
you
on?
Can't get me.
Did he have a little bathing suit
comes
on?
Comes in,
too?
Chases, and he goes back to the attic, right?
So what did you do?
So he calls the Humane Society. He's, listen, I set these traps. It's not working. You know, I don't want to hurt the animal, but, like, it's
right.
tormenting me. It's been, like, 2 months. I can't sleep. Imagine sleeping in this place
yes.
when there's a squirrel you know sleeping in the attic.
My worst part, my mother used to feed the squirrels, so that's even worse.
Right.
So they're like, oh, great. She thought it was, like, born free with the squirrels.
Right. So they said you can get these sticky traps. I don't want to hurt the animal, but get these sticky traps. This is like, you got to do this. So he set the sticky traps around the house. He comes home after work. The squirrel's stuck on the sticky trap. Going crazy, can't move. So he puts it in like a burlap sack and he goes, what do I do now? He goes, all right, you have to travel miles and miles away and just let the thing go free. He goes, so that's going to work? No problem. It will work. Okay, fine. So he goes to the Oyster Bay, takes the 135, goes up the Oyster Bay, north of this port on Long Island, lets it free. Thinks his problem's over. Nope. 2 days later, the squirrel is back in the house.
Wait, now, how do you know it's the same squirrel?
Well, I'll get to that, Rita.
Wait, did the squirrel have, like, a noticeable tattoo, or okay. what's the deal?
I get back to it. So, 2 days later, the squirrel's back, tormenting, back in the attic. He goes, what do I do now? Human sight, do the same thing. Get the traps. He goes, all right. Calls up. He goes, I had the squirrel. What do I do now? He goes, listen, it's overpopulation in the area. I suggest you fill up a garbage pail full of water and take care of it. He goes, what? He goes, yeah, it's over. You just got to do it.
Oh,
take care of it.
Okay, so.
So he does that. Squirrel goes away. No squirrel problem.
See that? And I'll bet you when he tried to drown that squirrel, that squirrel was fighting to get out of it.
That's a squirrel hunter. My mother would never. You know, I killed a spider in front of my mother one time. She didn't talk to me for a few days. My mother would
never.
She killed a squirrel.
She would
not talk to you for a year.
Well, let's go to Kenny. He is your Kumbata Cheech because he lives nearby in Valley Stream. Kenny, what did you do to get rid of your squirrel problems, Kenny?
Hi, Ken.
How you doing, Curtis Reader? What's up? Listen, we had squirrels in a rental house in Hempstead. 2 years. They are so resilient. They chewed through the aluminum siding through the house. Long story short, we did the hot pepper, hot this and that. What you got to do, they sell this trap. It looks like an English double-decker bus. No, it does. I mean, it's not red. It's a cage. It lets them leave. It doesn't let them back in.
Oh.
So it's going to take time. It's a really cool idea. One of the tenants' fathers told us about it.
No, Kenny.
That's how we got rid of it.
I'm going to ask you.
Patch them holes, man, because they'll come back, drive them miles away. You spray paint the tail, it takes like 7 miles before they don't come back.
Oh, my. Hey, no, quick question.
They come back.
On the double-decker bus.
Their house, believe me, we went through this. Unbelievable.
Do you let them out of the double-decker bus, or do they? Is it a one-way ticket sure, like Brian Mongoluch had?
No, the trap lets them leave, okay? It doesn't let them back, and then it closes. So basically, you'll have a squirrel in a trap. When you got to check it every day because they'll wind up going crazy in the trap. So I mean, you know,
that's a nice thing.
He didn't have a one way ticket like Brian Mongoluch did.
Well, let's go to Nick in Queens.
That's
welcome
what I was trying to get to.
Rita Cosby here on WABC. Nikki.
Hey, Curtis and Rita, I have a big problem. I live in Maspeth, and I have a small yard with a nice little grass area about 15 by 30, and the squirrels just come and dig and dig and dig, and this has been going on for years and years. So this double-decker trap that your previous caller had just mentioned may be a solution, because you don't really want to harm these little guys, but it's just a problem that I'm like, where do they get these nuts? Are they at Stop and Shop buying these nuts? No, my neighbor across the street that has all cement in his backyard, he feeds them. They come over to my yard, dig everything up.
Hey, Nick. Brian Mongalooch is listening. He's the one who gave them the one-way ticket. Did you hear this?
I didn't give them one-way ticket. My neighbor gave them the one-way ticket. It didn't happen to me.
Nick, is there something you'd like to say to Brian Mongalooch? Because obviously allow him.
I don't know. As much as it torments me every day, and I see them out there, I mean, before I go to work in the morning, I go out and before I water the lawn, they've already had 20 squirrel dig holes there with their nuts, and they torment me. Well, they leave it at the steps, like a nut at the steps is just a torment, like a calling card.
But Brian Mongalooch is a squirrel killer.
I'm
not going to drown the squirrels.
He's a squirrel murderer.
But when we come back, I need help because nobody's going to want to buy this house that my mom and dad left behind.
Yeah, I wouldn't advertise that it's filled with squirrels.
You can't hope but let the people know because you're going to hear it when they come to look at the house. Hey, here, they're running through the walls.
Well, when you have the squirrels, what is it, a squirrel crow? A squirrel scarecrow out? Yeah. That'll do it.
No, a plastic owl mounted on a pole. 1-800-848-WABC. To the phones we go. And in fact, it's Danny who's calling from Long Island. Welcome to Curtis and Rita Cosby here. Danny, I need help. The squirrels have invaded my parents' house.
Help.
You got a lot of cats in your house. Well, you got a lot of cats in your house. You should put some in that house. And the squirrel would smell the cat in there.
Well, you know, Danny, that's a good idea because today is Black Cat Appreciation Day.
Although you want to stay away from the black cats,
well,
you know,
that's the
superstitious.
Problem, because there is so much superstition. My wife, Nancy, as everyone knows, rescues cats and then finds homes for them.
But that's what I'm saying. Put them to work. Well, you give them a free home, put them to work.
We have the two black cats. You can go on the Curtis and Cosby Facebook page, Apollo, who was rescued from a kill shelter in East New York, and Angel, who lost an eye in Sunset Park to Nancy Rescue. We can't adopt them. Nobody wants black cats. So maybe that's what I'll do. I'll put them out there in the yard in Canarsie.
They are getting free room and board from you and Nancy, so the least they can do is work. And by the way, everybody, coming up, you don't want to miss this because we are going to be talking to New York's head of the Sergeant Benevolent Association. We are talking to Ed Mullins because, speaking of work, he is frustrated. He represents so many cops in the city, and he feels that they can't work, that they can't do their jobs because you got all these thugs like the ones on the 28th Street precinct and so many of the others that are just livid and going after them and don't respect the cops. He is coming up for an interview with us. He's coming up at 1 o'clock. He is furious. He wrote a letter to the commissioner saying, help us, help us.
What happened to Pat Lynch? How come he's MIA?
Curtis and Cosby.
The group dedicated to fight crime.
They're gonna chase it down.
From the street perspective, Curtis Sleeve.
All of it.
Please welcome Rita Cosby.
There's a lot of heat on the president.
The headlines, the issues, the people.
America!
From New York to D.C. to your neighborhood.
The Red Berets are helping the cities in fear.
Curtis Sliwa.
Founder and president of the Guardian Angels, Curtis Sliwa.
Rita Cosby.
Rita, that was an explosive interview.
Live, local, on it. Curtis and Cosby.
Curtis Sliwa.
Rita Cosby.
Curtis
Cosby.
77 WABC.
It is 106 here on 77 WABC. You're listening to Curtis and Cosby, and that's the theme from NYPD Blue. Well, a lot of officers with the NYPD, men and women, who I think have a very, very difficult job on their hands. Well, they are feeling blue, and they are feeling frustrated because there are so many thugs that are sort of taking it to officers. They are disrespecting officers and really making their jobs, I think, so much more difficult. There were reports, as we talked about, of what happened at the 40th precinct, where there were a number of officers who were just verbally assaulted and just harassed by a group of young people with their cell phones all over the place. And then who can forget what we were talking about on the show recently, the other case where a guy walks in at the 28th precinct using his cell phone, and he was just throwing every single swear word and assaulting verbally the sergeant there on duty. Take a listen.
Yep, Sergeant Lopez, he could suck the big You're supposed to be here to serve and protect, right? You're not serving to protect. Shut the up, bitch. I'm gonna put it in your.
I can record what I want.
Where it says? Where it says I can't record it?
You can't record outside prison.
Why not?
You can't record.
Why not?
You cannot record.
Why?
You cannot record it.
Why?
You can't record outside prison.
Why? Tell me why. I don't know.
You're recording.
Tell me why. Tell me why.
The law says you can't.
Why? What law? What law is that?
You have handcuffs?
What's the law?
You don't even know. You're
what's the law?
You can't record outside prison.
Why not?
Doesn't
I'm here. I can't record over there. I can record what I want to record at. You can't tell me what the do. It's my phone. You don't pay my bill. You don't. I do what the want with my phone. Y'all love taking people's bikes, right? Where your handcuffs at? You piece of
It's so disgusting to hear that. That's a sergeant who's taking that verbal assault from a thug who, by the way, after all that, wasn't even arrested. And now the head of the Sergeants Benevolent Association, Ed Mullins, has had enough, and he has written a letter to Commissioner, NYPD Commissioner James O'Neill. And joining us exclusively here on Curtis and Cosby is Ed Mullins, the head of the Sergeants Union. Ed, first of all, tell us why you wrote this letter. I feel for the cops, for the great men and women in this city, because I think it is disgusting that people like that guy that we just played feel that they have free rein and they're not even getting arrested.
Well, Rita, I appreciate that. And, you know, why I wrote this letter is what we're seeing is an epidemic of empowerment for individuals who are basically police hating individuals. And if we go back about 4 years ago, we've seen this happening in New York City. We had protests in the street, pigs in a blanket. NYPD tolerated all of that. In fact, so much so that we had two police officers assassinated while they were having their lunch in a car. The answer we got back then was we thought less officers would be injured by allowing a protest and not making the arrest. Well, ultimately, we had two killed. Now we see in the 40th precinct, you know, verbal abuse, empowering of, you know, criminal activity. And make no mistake, what's occurring is disorderly conduct under the New York State Penal Law. But officers are choosing to not make these arrests because they don't feel we have the backing of the NYPD. We don't feel we have the backing of the mayor's office. When things get ugly, we saw a video in the 3-4 precinct went on for 9 minutes while one police officer was fighting with an individual who was refusing to be handcuffed. And so much so that it took almost 20 officers to respond to the scene and render assistance. Everyone's grabbing their cell phone cameras and video and trying to make an incident where we have bad cops. There aren't a city filled with bad cops. You know, do we have bad cops? In any profession, we have people that don't do the job the right way. They become bad cops. They become bad surgeons, attorneys, all of that. But at the end of the day, 99.9% of the members of the NYPD go to work every day trying to help people. And if we take the position of we're not getting supported, what's the adverse effect of that? Public safety. If we're not going to engage the criminals in the street, then what happens to the public when this becomes a hands-off policy? Now, I've been in three separate boroughs today. I was in the Bronx, I was in Manhattan, and in Queens. And I spoke to officers in all boroughs, and they are all in agreement that they're afraid to engage because they don't feel we have the support of Commissioner O'Neill, of the chief of department, of the rest of the chiefs. And that letter that was sent to put everyone on notice that you are causing this atmosphere. And it went to all the chiefs and all the commissioners so that they can't sit back and say they didn't know if a cop gets seriously injured or killed.
Are you worried? Let me ask you, Ed Mullins, and we're talking to Ed Mullins, the head of the Sergeants Union here in New York. You're saying put them on notice. How bad is it? How dangerous is it for, obviously, officers and also the community here in New York City?
Well, think about it. The first line of defense to the community in New York City is the police officers, and they want to make these arrests. They want to engage. But what happens when you look at the video in the 40th precinct, where these individuals are following the cops down the stairs? What happens when one of them decides to feel more empowered, goes to the roof and throws a bottle or a brick off the roof? as we had happen back in the 80s, where a police officer had a paint bucket dumped from the roof and it killed him. So this has to stop before someone else gets killed or seriously injured. And what really should happen is one of the chiefs that set these policies, they should lead by example and go out and put their handcuffs on these individuals and set the example that this isn't going to be tolerated.
So what would you say? What would you say to Commissioner O'Neill? I mean, it sounds like he's leaving you guys hanging.
Well, that's the pulse of the rank and file. I mean, the response that came from headquarters yesterday was pathetic, that, you know, we're living in another world. I've spoken to cops all week long, and again today. We're not living in another world. I've spoken to the people involved in these incidents. This is something that is out of control, and O'Neill has to come out and publicly back the police officers. I get the Gardner case. I get the graphics of what looks bad. I get the politics of trying to balance the playing field with the community. No one wants the community that doesn't trust the police. I get all of that. But at the end of the day, there's a partnership that's supposed to go two ways. And when you see a community just taking pictures and videotaping police officers, that's not a partnership with the police. Not when you're sitting there struggling to make an arrest and no one's calling 911, no one's coming to assist. And if it doesn't turn out pretty, you get disciplined for it because it didn't turn out pretty. Well, police officers are given a gun. They're given the equipment, the tasers and mace, to use force as necessary. And we need to hear, use whatever force necessary to make those arrests, to protect yourself, and to ensure that the criminals are not running rampant in these neighborhoods.
How worried are you, Ed Mullins? How worried are you for New York City and for the officers?
Reader, I'll tell you how worried I am. That back when Ramos and Lou were killed, I had a meeting amongst all my delegates telling them that this had to stop and that we needed to address this. 24 hours later, we had two police officers assassinated. That's how worried I am. That I was right back then, and I see this happening again now. And this is not a fairy tale as they like to present to the general public. I have spoken to people wearing uniforms. I have visited precincts today, and everyone is telling me the same thing. They're afraid they're going to not be supported by the police commissioner, by the mayor's administration, by other chiefs, who everyone's afraid of what looks ugly on camera. Well, the truth for the people of the city of New York, sometimes police work gets ugly. Sometimes people get seriously hurt, and sometimes they die. And that happens to cops on a regular basis, as we can see across the country. But there is no reason to continue to foster this type of atmosphere where we're going to put people's lives in danger.
Now, Edward Mullins, as president of the Sergeant Benevolence Association, if we could just focus on this individual walking into the 28th precinct, filming it, and then uploading it so everyone else can watch how impotent the two police officers, one Sergeant Lopez he identified, and then a female officer who was sitting there at a desk doing some work. I noticed this female officer never once looked up. Sergeant Lopez was asking her if she had cuffs. None of them had cuffs. He goes to the back to make a call. I'm thinking maybe to a superior officer. What is the training like? Because I got to tell you, if I went into City Hall and tried to start filming and yelling like that or One Police Plaza, I'd be sucking concrete. So what is the training that goes into police officers now that would allow them to let an invader come into a precinct?
Well, it's a great question, and I'll tell you, there's patrol guide section 203.29 that prohibits photographing inside a police precinct. And if the individual refuses, they can be arrested. Now, I just left the 28th precinct today. Believe it or not, there's always a set of handcuffs behind the desk. For whatever reason, it wasn't there that morning. And the officer at the front desk and the sergeant involved have indicated that they're afraid of the ramifications of what happens when this goes ugly. You touch on a very serious topic of training that the NYPD will tell you all the time about training. But in the end, our training, I call liability training. You get basic training to cover what's needed in order to go back out on patrol and to say you were trained. There should be secured areas of precincts where you just cannot come in, especially in the day where we're dealing with terrorism on a regular basis. Yeah, think of this, if this was a person wearing a bomb vest and walked into a precinct. How do you have the ability to just walk in and approach a desk like that? But these prisons are open to the general public, and we understand why. More importantly, what about a sex crimes victim who may be in the station house? What about undercovers? What about members of the community who are in there talking about drug dealers in the neighborhood who are now on film? These are all issues that each precinct should have a policy posted in big letters of no photographs, and you will be arrested for trespassing. And we need to know that we're going to be back when you make those arrests, and if there's resistant arrest and injuries occur and someone does have to go to a hospital as a result of it, that we are supported by this department. And there is great doubt as to that happening right now.
You know, I want to ask you, Ed Mullins, you wrote the letter, obviously, to O'Neill. What would you say to the mayor? How much role do you think he has played? Because there have been incidents where, obviously, cops turned their backs at those some of those funerals to the mayor.
I think the incidents with the mayor in the past, I think the mayor realizes how vital the NYPD is to his success and to the success of the city.
But the police commissioner reports to him, you know. I mean, you know, they work tandem.
I don't know the conversations that occur between the two. But, you know, it was presented to me yesterday by a very high-ranking official in the NYPD. He said, realize that in a city that elects officials that want to hand off policy of criminals, that this is the method of policing that's going to occur. If you're electing people that are out there to get law and order to take place, and we don't have our politicians jumping in front of ambulances and abusing the police and taking photographs and things like that, then the police will also feel empowered to make those arrests. What's important is to have a fine line between using the right force and making arrests under circumstances where emotion doesn't come into play, and it's not perceived that the police are abusing the public. And there's great concern about that. But I think we're capable of finding that balance, provided we have the leadership that sets that tone, and that's what's missing right now.
Now, Ed Mullins, you're the leader of the Sergeant Benevolence Association. There are quite a few sergeants. You have a Lieutenant Benevolent Association, a Captain's Benevolent Association. But all of your memberships pale in comparison to the PBA and Pat Lynch. Pat Lynch has been missing in action on this. Well, where is he? Is he on vacation? He said nothing.
I don't hear, you know, I can't speak for Pat Lynch. I can't speak for his members. I do know I see Pat out there plenty of times in the field. So that's a question you're going to have to ask what the PBA's policy is. I can't imagine that Pat's not for the safety of police officers.
Let me ask you, what would be your message, Ed, to the mayor and to the commissioner? Help you? What is your message?
I think we'd like to see some very clear leadership as to what duties you want us to do. If you want a hands-off policy, then be very clear. Come out and say it. If you want us to make arrests, then someone should get to the front of the pack, whether it be the chief of patrol, chief of department, take their cuffs out and set the stage by example so the people of the city of New York see the message and the cops see the message and we'll all follow right behind. But until that happens, we don't need fancy press statements of ambiguity. We want a factual direction of where we're going to go as far as policing goes. And, you know, I think the cops are all aware that, you know, we don't want bad cops. We don't want to see abuse. We don't want, quotas and stop and frisk. I think we're all in agreement for that. But at the end of the day, this isn't just about taking video of police officers. This is about empowering criminals that sooner or later are going to cause some serious damage or death to a police officer. And it's having an adverse impact to the public.
How concerned and how, I guess, scared or concerned are officers on the street right now? And how would you describe this climate?
Officers are concerned to the point that they're, you know, trying to look out for each other and to watch each other's back and to be able to get through the day and hopefully not have anything happen that jeopardizes anyone's safety. And that's the mentality of what I am getting from the people I've spoken with in the past few days and today.
Well, we are always with you guys on the street. I know how hard the guys and the gals work there, Ed Mullins, and we appreciate it. It's such an important role, and we all agree with you. Listen, the cops have to have somebody watching their backs to protect all of us. We appreciate what you do. Ed Mullins, great to have you here, and I hope we can bring some attention in this exclusive interview to City Hall and also to the head of the police department, too, as well.
Well, let's open up our phone numbers, if we can, to everyone out there. Sergeant Mullins has laid down the gauntlet and said, hey, you've handcuffed our cops, and now you have an invasion of a police precinct at 28th with absolutely no arrests made in its aftermath. What do you want us to do? 1-800-848-WABC. That's 1-800-848-9222. Anyway, let's go to Bob, who's calling from New York. What did you think of our conversation with Sergeant Mullins, Bob?
Hey, Curtis, how you doing? So pretty much, Bob, from a guy who's been on the streets for a long time working in the NYPD, I just have to say I think there's a lot of ignorance out there in the community about how difficult it is to arrest somebody. And sometimes I think you have to kind of challenge people just to, for them to get an indication of how difficult it is to arrest somebody. You have a pair of handcuffs, which is the chain is about 2 inches long. When somebody tells you they don't want to go or they don't want to be arrested, you know it's going to be almost impossible to arrest these people.
But hey, let me say one thing. I agree with you on that. On the other hand, you can't allow lawlessness either. You can't allow them coming into the police department, into the 28th precinct, and saying, you know, F you. I mean, you heard all the language, all that stuff.
I understand. I'm talking about the image. The NYPD really needs to show people what it's like when a person decides that they don't want to arrest you. You know, I'm bold enough. I will challenge any criminal in the city of New York to try to arrest me. I guarantee you it would take him and his whole little gang to put handcuffs on me. That's how ugly sometimes situations look on the street.
All right, but Bob, as a street smart cop, you know that if you shrink away, if the mutts and skells out there are screaming at you, invectives, challenging you, chasing you down the block, that's going to make it worse for the next group of cops who come onto that block.
Absolutely. But I'm saying that their concern is that they don't want to engage with people because they're afraid that it's going to look ugly. Well, you need to educate the community to tell them, look, it's probably not going to look good, and this is the reasons why.
But you know what? You know what? That has to come from the boss, and that's exactly the point that Ed Mullins was saying, is that they want to do that. They know it's tough, and believe me, you know, I have incredible support for the men and women out there. But if the boss says, oh, be careful, you don't want it to look bad like you're talking about, then their hands are tied. And that's what Ed Mullins was just telling us, Curtis.
Well, he said the chief of patrol, and he's absolutely right, Sergeant Mullins, needs to set the example, pull his handcuffs out, and start making arrests and sort of educating the new cops on the job the way they want it.
But if they don't have the commissioner who's saying that's okay to do it,
but
that's a problem for all of us.
But he also acknowledged that his own Sergeant Lopez at the 28th Precinct did not have handcuffs behind the desk,
right,
which is required.
And they didn't arrest him afterwards,
right,
either.
Neither,
you know,
did his the female cop who was sitting at the desk processing paperwork. So you got to come prepared. I mean, let's face it. Somebody will come into your house,
right,
and you're entitled to have handcuffs, as cops are, and you can't even find a pair of handcuffs in the whole precinct?
In the precinct,
we
too,
can't
ironically.
We can't blame O'Neill.
Right.
And obviously, Comrade de Blasio, the part-time mayor, the dope from Park Slope for that one.
No, you're right. They have to be prepared, but they also have to feel like when they do take initiative that someone has their back.
Well, let's go right now for our news headlines and updates.
Don't criticize it.
Yaman, it is 1:39 here on 77 WABC. You're listening to Curtis and Cosby. And this is a dilemma that I think a lot of people are going to be facing now with all the new different medical marijuana laws and legalizing of marijuana in the different states, whether New York, New Jersey, Connecticut. It's an issue that's going to come up a lot more often, and it came up for a guy in Bridgeton, New Jersey, which is in Cumberland County. Now, when he got hired by this company, and it's a private company, when he got hired, he said, I'm taking certain medicines, and I'm also using medical marijuana, all prescribed by a doctor. It's to treat pain from an injury that he suffered. And he said that this is what I'm doing, and, you know, it's medical marijuana is allowed. He got all the proper paperwork, went through all the stuff that, like you did, you know, Curtis, you go through that whole big process
sure,
there, you know.
Sure.
And so then suddenly his company says, well, we want to do a mandatory drug test. This is sort of our process. We're a private company. We're allowed to do it. And needless to say, he goes through the process and there's a problem. And then he says, well, wait a minute, I'm supposed to get a waiver from this. So now a court has ruled basically and said that a company, even though there are rules on the book and people can get medical marijuana, certainly, but if a private company, and it makes a little bit of a distinction between a private company and a public company, that if a private company still wants to test you for medical marijuana, if their rules are we don't want someone to have drugs in the system, that he should not be allowed to do it. And the judge ruled the opposite, saying that a private company has that protection, no matter what the laws are in the state of New Jersey and no matter what the laws are in the state. So this, I think, it's such a fascinating case, Curtis, because this is going to come up time and time again. And I remember you talking about this when you were out in California, because
That's
right. they were sort of leading the trend out there on a number of things. But this is going to happen a lot of times, too. And he's making the case, saying, listen, this is who they knew that I was going. They were hiring. They were hiring someone who had medicinal marijuana. I shouldn't be discriminated against. There shouldn't be issues. But a judge has ruled, and a number of them have said, that decriminalization of medical marijuana does not shield employees from adverse employment actions. In other words, you're in a private company, no matter whatever the laws are on the books, and even if you went through the legal processes, which you should do, obviously, as you did, Curtis, and we've talked about that on the show, that you are not protected, that it still is up to an individual employer to decide what he wants to do. So,
right. So in this particular guy's case, he's been working straight through. Crane operator.
Yep.
He had a serious head neurological injury in which a doctor prescribed Percocet and medical marijuana.
Yep.
So he gets this job. He comes clean with them up front. He goes, hey, I got to let you know I'm physically able to work. But I'm still using medical marijuana that I am prescribed in the state of New Jersey. If you register and you get a doctor's note with it, you can get medical marijuana. They didn't have a problem hiring him, putting him out there in the workforce, but they have these mandatory drug tests. For instance, as you know, and I thank you for remembering that, Rita, I warned everyone coming back from California and Colorado, where I had visited Guardian Angels, that just because they have medical marijuana and now legal recreational use of marijuana, it doesn't mean that your employers can't drug test you and toss you out.
And I think that's so fascinating. I remember when you brought it up, Curtis, I was like, because it's such an interesting, people don't think about
the
it.
The law needs to catch up with the decisions that have been made either through initiative and referendum in Colorado and California or by state legislatures. But in this case, the guy is completely open and transparent. The company had no problem. Now, I'm in that same precarious position here at Cumulus. That's our employer. They do drug tests from time to time. At least they can, if they so choose, as a private company.
By the way, they started that when they knew you got hired. They're right. Like, okay, well, now we got to really clamp down
on that. But because of my colitis and ileitis that developed into full-blown chronic Crohn's disease, I now am able to legally take marijuana in the state of New York. But if all of a sudden
they say, right, isn't that wild?
Let's say HR came
yes.
in, and this is how they operate.
Right.
They don't tell you in advance.
Yeah, they say, hey, come back to the bathroom. Right.
HR said, hey, you know, come to the little boy's room. We want you to urinate into this little vial. I would have to do it. I would fail the test. I could be fired according to the rules and regulations of the company. And I've been warning, almost like Paul Revere, warning people out there, this guy lost his job this month.
Exactly.
That's it. No severance pay, no nothing. He failed the drug test, even though he was legally prescribed medical marijuana in New Jersey. Our number is 1-800-848-WABC. Now, don't you think this law needs to be changed, ladies and gentlemen?
And let me ask you, too, does it matter what you do also for a living, too? Because there's a whole bunch of layers to it. But it's a lot of gray area, because you think about how many people are taking medical marijuana right now. And what are bosses going to do? Have you had a discussion with your boss? And do you realize that if it is a private company, like you're talking about with Cumulus, and in this guy's case, too, that they can do what they want? I actually think he hasn't. I'm actually surprised he didn't win this case.
And he's not alone.
I know.
Courts in California and Colorado
it's
and across
amazing,
the nation,
Curtis.
Federal courts have ruled on behalf of the employers. Now, you would suggest that maybe the employers need to loosen their regulations.
Right, and that's what
and
I want to ask everybody.
Catch up to the way the laws have changed. But there are a lot of corporations out there say, tough noogies.
Yeah, what do you do? What do you get, like a waiver? Because what I think is interesting in this case,
tough
especially,
noogies.
He told them ahead of time, Curtis. That's what I think is so fascinating, that he said, listen, I'm taking this. I got this. And by the way, some of the problems also, he also had some problems while on the job, but not related to his performance.
No.
But he actually told his employers and they hired him anyway. So that's where I'm actually surprised he still got fired.
He was never cited for poorly performing or being derelict in terms of his duties or an incorrigible. Instead, HR eventually said,
you're fired.
That's
so,
it.
Yeah.
You're gone.
So
out on your tuchus.
Is it fair, everybody? It's 1-800-848-9222. 1-800-848-9222.
Let's go to Bruce in New Jersey. Welcome to Curtis and Rita Cosby here on WABC. Bruce.
How you doing?
Good. How you doing?
I'm doing wonderful. I drive a truck for a living, and we can't take drugs, of course. But think about this. Booze is legal, but you can't drink on the job. Right?
Yeah, but that's not medicinal. Now,
not medicinal. Come on.
What is that?
What, some people
what,
claim it
fifth,
is.
A fifth, like, a
Come
fifth
on.
Is
Come
medicinal?
On, tell the truth. It ain't medicinal. You just like it.
Oh, wait a second. Okay.
Now so, the truth
what
comes
is
out.
So let me get this straight, Bruce. I get prescribed medical marijuana because I was on oxycodone, hillbilly heroin, for 2.5 years. You would rather have me addicted to hillbilly heroin or Percocet or Vicodin rather than using medical marijuana, right?
Well, not necessarily, but why were you on the Percocet?
Well, because I had chronic Crohn's disease. I had a 12-hour operation. Do you not realize that if the operation didn't work, they were telling me, hey, guess what? Prepare for hospice.
Okay.
All right. Oh, now all of a sudden, Bruce has a little change of attitude.
No,
there. Although some of our listeners, of course not. That would have been comfort care, right? I would have been saying, yeah, I'm going for comfort care. And everyone would have recognized, that's it. Lights out, Curtis Sliwa. And some of our listeners would have preferred that.
By the way, I think some of them, I think I hear from about 10 of them a day.
let's go to Alex, who's calling 10,000, from New Jersey. Welcome to Curtis and Rita Cosby here at WABC. Alex.
Hi, Alex.
Hey, how you doing, Curtis and Rita? Just a question. What if the guy smokes after work during the weekend and he's not high during, you know, during while he's working?
And by the way, that doesn't matter. Positive. That doesn't matter because in this case, they're not saying he was, like, stoned on the job.
Alex, just to inform you, it does not mean because you take medical marijuana, you're stoned. There are three different types of marijuana. What you're
Correct.
Thinking is the marijuana that gets you high. There are marijuanas you could take, the liquid under your tongue, the little gummy bears, cookies, in
gotcha.
Which it sedates your pain, but you don't get a buzz from it.
But he said, but Alex is making the distinction, thinking that he was doing it on the job. That's not the allegation that he was even doing anything.
He could have been
saying,
Alex, they have a pill. They had it before legalized medical marijuana called Myrinol. You don't have any TCP in Myrinol, but it suppresses the pain. And for some people, it's much more preferred than even Advil or Tylenol, which comes with its own set of problems.
But and it still stays in the system regardless, like we talked about yesterday. You know,
as long as he can perform his job and he does his work well, I don't see the big deal.
Right.
I know, and that's why I'll tell you, Alex, I am surprised because he also told his employer ahead of time. I think it's totally unfair. And I think it's ridiculous. And I think it's a sign of what's to come. I think we're going to see a lot more like
right.
this.
That's right. As soon as
you're fired.
The federal court rule, he's gone.
Yeah, he's already gone.
Let's go
he's
to
gone.
Neil, who's calling from Brooklyn. Welcome to Curtis and Rita Cosby here on WABC. Neil.
Hi, Neil.
How you doing? I think you're totally right when it comes to the strains of marijuana. The CBD oil doesn't have no THC in it, so you're really not high. But I don't think since the federal government doesn't...
Ooh, Neil, you're hurting us with the little... We got phone issues today. Neil?
Yeah, my phone's going crazy.
Yeah,
What happened is that they don't have marijuana. So what
No, I think we're
losing.
This
is
our third caller that we've lost.
I know. You know what?
Ever since we questioned the power grid that Cuomo wants to close Indian Point and Murphy Oyster Creek, the nuclear power plants.
We didn't use the word Oyster Creek, though, in the last 5 minutes. So we're not on the radar. You would have thought we would have been okay on this segment.
Let's go to John, who's calling from Brooklyn. Welcome to Curtis and Rita Cosby here on WABC. Johnny.
Hi, John.
Hello, you guys. I have a commercial driver's license. And because it's commercial, I'm not allowed to. It's covered under federal licensing now. You're not allowed to take any drugs that are considered a federal crime. So marijuana and heroin, they're all listed as narcotics.
But hey, John, let me ask you: what about medicinal? What if you said, "Listen, I desperately need it." Would that not apply? Obviously, too, right?
Absolutely. I would tell you this much. It's not considered medicinal under the federal government.
All right. But John, let me give you an example, because we've had a heroin problem for years. The alternative for some people is to get prescribed methadone, go to the methadone clinic. I know of men and women who drive vehicles, whether it's 18-wheel tractor trailers, buses, or just regular vans or cars, who will go and get their methadone supplement every day, the alternative to heroin, and they're fine.
Yeah, although, you know what? I understand why the government and companies are a little concerned when you're dealing with driving. You don't want an airline pilot. I don't want a pilot, even if he's on medicinal marijuana. What if he doesn't have it organized? I don't know.
What about if he's prescribed Percocet or Vicodin or hillbilly heroin oxycodone?
I think he needs to stay home.
Yeah, but you see, there are a lot of people, Rita, who really do need those drugs.
Oh,
and
listen,
they do function.
I agree.
Because it gives them a pain-free atmosphere so that they can stretch, they can bend, they can do the things, all the things that are required as part of the physical part of their job.
I just think there's too many gray areas when you're dealing with some severe, with any kind of medication that's sort of a serious. And again, it's got to be looked at, but I think when you're in a public safety position, no.
1-800-848-WABC.
I don't ever wanna let you go. But I can't wait to get to watch you grow. And no matter what this life might bring, I want you to know that you will always be. You will always be.
7 minutes after the hour or two, as we're high atop Madison Square Garden, the great facilities provided to us in order to do this broadcast to all of you on the 50,000 powerful watts of sound provided by NJDiet.com. This story is a heartbreaker. Has been replicated across our country time and time again, except in this case, it deals with a birth mother in New Jersey. She delivered into the world a son called Baby J in court papers. And she had gone to an adoption agency and gave the child up for adoption. Now, she now claims that she was misled and they had failed to inform her about her alternatives to adoption. But a husband and a wife from outside of the state of New Jersey were contacted by the adoption agency. They had been seeking a child of their own for quite some time. And they took Baby J into their home. At the time, Baby J was progressing, second month, third month, fourth month, no problems. And Gloria Roman, a 20-year-old receptionist from Union County, said, No. I want my son back. So she went to family court with her attorney, and a family court judge agreed and ordered that the baby's adoptive parents, who had raised him since birth, return the boy to his birth mother last year. But the adoptive family appealed the judge's ruling, allowing them to keep the child while the case worked its way through the courts. And then last week, the three-judge appellate panel agreed in a unanimous decision that the 13-month-year-old boy called Baby J must remain with the adoptive parents. Naturally, the birth mother was devastated. Neither side left the court feeling at all elated. And this is what the birth mother had to say about why she so badly wanted baby Jay back with her.
I was scared. So I felt like I didn't know what to do at the time.
And then she went on.
I want to do everything I possibly can to at least fight for him and try to get him back, just because I felt like I wasn't told everything I was supposed to be told.
Now, she has no ill will towards the adoptive parents. She thought they were doing a good job raising the baby because they had kept her informed. They were sending her pictures. They were giving her updates as to how baby Jay was doing.
Yeah, she blames actually the state of New Jersey that they withheld information about other alternatives.
Well, she says, look at me. I'm 20 now. I'm working. I'm stable. I have my own place to live. At the time I had my child, I was 19. Working part-time and living with my mother. But we had financial problems, and we were evicted from our house. The baby's father did not want to help me at all. I didn't even want to tell my sister and my mother that I was pregnant, so I kept it on the hush-hush.
And there are a lot of people that are dealing with this kind of situation, Curtis, where life circumstances change. I remember, years ago interviewing a woman who was definitely down and out, gave her child up for adoption. Suddenly she became to a point where she was making a lot of money and felt at this point she could have her child. And it took years upon years upon years to be able to try to resolve this. And so many parents out there, how many of you have had issues with the adoption agency? And who do you feel for in this case? Because part of me, I'll tell you, Curtis, when I see this, it is so heartbreaking because you feel for the mom who obviously had the child and was not ready at the time and had to deal with all of these issues and now is at a place where she wants to have the child back. You feel for the adoptive parents who did a very nice thing out there adopting, these children who are, desperately need
right,
love and want love.
They did it with the idea it would be permanent,
yeah.
Not a foster care situation.
That's why I'm saying my heart breaks for them.
Caretakers. And now the young lady, the mother, the birth mother, just a year later. So we're not talking 6 years, seven
right.
years later. Because
right.
then you would say, hey, wait a second.
I think this, it makes it tougher. Yeah,
right.
I'm
but
with
a
you.
Year later, she is now working a full-time job. She's living in a house in Roselle Park and plans to return to Kane University to earn her bachelor's degree. She's saying, I can take care of my child. I don't need my baby daddy at all. Mm-hmm. He's basically abandoned ship.
Like a number of daddies do.
Right. My mother and my sister have come to terms that's right, I had a child out of wedlock, but they're more than happy to help me in raising my son. But the courts won't permit me to get my son back. If you had to be a Solomon-like judge
right,
here.
Right, right.
And ladies and gentlemen, you were looking at the adoptive parents from out of state who have been raising baby Jay for 13 months and looking at the birth mother, Roman, right now. Who would you give that child to? 1-800-848-WABC. That's 1-800-848-9222.
I think, Curtis, there should be some rule where, I mean, part of me feels like the adoptive parents, because they did such a generous thing. I think people that adopt kids, whether it's in America, sometimes they go to Russia or China, wherever it is to get kids. Romania is also a popular spot. I've had friends who've adopted from various countries all over the world. I think they are so generous and so giving and so kind. But yet, I sort of feel for this woman. Maybe it needs to be where there is like a 12-month window and you have the decision, or 6-month window or something like that, where if something turns around. But I also feel so bad for these adoptive parents
in New Jersey,
who out of the kindness of their heart took the child in.
Rita, and it differs from state to state, but in New Jersey, the law says a birth parent must wait at least 72 hours after the baby's birth to sign the surrender documents to give up a baby for adoption. But the birth mother is saying, hey, I was never told all the other alternatives.
And that's where it gets into the sticky area, because they say that she said there were other options. Can we prove that she wasn't told what are the other options out there? What are some of the other gray areas? If she maybe wasn't told, then that's different.
Well,
what do you do to this poor couple?
The government would set you up in a Section 8 house, pay your rent. You get food stamps.
Right.
You would get assistance. She said, I was never told that. And she didn't come from a background, obviously, where that was just part of what you did. pop out the babies, get your own apartment.
Which a number of them
right,
do.
Right, get the food stamps so you can get out of a house of 8 kids that, in fact, as the oldest child, you had to take care of.
And by the way, how many times do you see parents that have, or moms, I should say, often, that have like 8 kids and you're like, wait a minute. But in this case, there has to be something for the adopted parents,
baby.
The parents who took the baby in.
What do we do with this baby mama drama? Let's go to Ann first up in the queue in Manhattan. Welcome to Curtis and Rita Cosby here on WABC. Ann.
Hi, Ann.
Hi, guys. I think it should stay with the adoptive parents because I'm sure that they are in a position to give a good life. And we don't know about this mom who was in a bad situation. Now you can wants to raise the child with government help and all that. It's not fair.
Yeah, well, and also
she
don't know.
She doesn't want it anymore.
She could flake out again. And she could flake out again.
Well, remember, she's not asking for government assistance. She's saying it took me a year to get on my feet. I have a house in Roselle Park. I work a good job. I'm going to go to Kane College to finish getting credits for a graduate degree.
But what if it all falls apart again and then she wants to adopt the child again? Come on.
Let's go to Lynn, who's calling from Patchogue, Long Island. Welcome to Curtis and Rita Cosby here on WABC. Lynn.
Hi, Lynn.
Hi, how you doing? I am an adoptive mother. My husband and I have 4 children.
Oh, bravo. Bravo.
Thank you. We've been very blessed, but one of the things we always said was if we felt that a birth mother had made the wrong decision in the period of time where the law allows, that we would never keep a baby that a birth mother, you know, wanted back. I couldn't live with myself. I just respect and love our birth mothers so much. All of my 4 children, ages 19 to 27, have all met their birth parents, birth mothers, actually.
Oh, wow, that's
and I
cool.
I could never do that to
Lynn,
a mother.
Let me ask you, what is the time where you are? What is the window, the legal time? What if they came back after the window like this woman is doing?
Well, I don't know. I would have a hard time with it after the window. I can't remember now. My youngest is 19, but I believe it was a 45-day window. And I can tell you with the last one, I sweated it out, even though I had a close relationship with her. She actually sent me flowers on day 45 and said, "We're so happy that you're going to be his parents, and it was the right decision."
Wow. Lynn, listening to you, they made the right call. You and your dad, obviously,
Lynn,
or husband, have a big heart.
All during this time where you and your husband were raising these 4 adopted kids, you said you let them have access to their birth mother, correct?
They always knew they were adopted. When they got older, of course, through Facebook, they figured a lot out on their own. But I supported, and my husband and I supported, them meeting each of their birth mothers. 3 out of 4 of the meetings went very, very well. One of them went well and then turned sour just because the birth mother had a little bit of an issue about our religion, which I didn't understand.
Yeah, and you're like, wait a minute, I took them in. Come on.
Yeah, my daughter with that particular one said, "You should be proud the way my parents raised me and not have to question, you know, our religion."
Bravo, bravo.
Now this sense that children, in some instances, who were abandoned for all the wrong reasons, want to find out who their birth parent is, whether it's the mother or the father. Did it ever stick in your mind that all of a sudden, once they discovered who their birth mother or father was, that they would no longer have the closeness to you and your husband?
Never. Never. My kids have always been raised honoring and respecting their birth mothers, but they also knew that we were their parents and we sacrificed for them. And I always felt there's enough love for more than myself and my husband to love my children.
Wow.
And that's how it has been. We actually went to the wedding of a couple of our birth mothers.
Hey, Lynn.
These were young.
Will you adopt me? You sound like an amazing parent. I want to be adopted.
I still have no money from all these adoptions, but it was well worth it, and it's been a beautiful thing.
Wow, you've been to the weddings.
And it doesn't always work out that way. I've had friends who, A, don't want to know who their birth parents are because they feel like I was raised by these parents, and these are the ones I love, and
I think a lot of the kids are curious.
And I respect, by the way, I respect either way because it's such a personal decision.
And remember, it's so easy now as opposed to years ago.
Tracking down
who those people might be. Anyway, let's go to Giuseppe. Joey calling from Brooklyn. Welcome to Curtis and Rita Cosby here on WABC. Joey.
Hi, Joe.
Yes. Hi, Rita. Hi, Curtis. So here's what I'm thinking, and I don't know what's right or what's wrong, but I would think that if I was that child, I would want to know when I'm able to figure these things out at 11 or 12 or 13. Why did my mother give me up? Where is my mother? What is she dead? Is that why I'm with you? I would want to find my mother.
Joe, I would be curious. I would be curious. But also, I also understand the allegiance too. To, you know, when my father left the family when I was a teenager, it was quite abrupt. And for a long time, I had a very strong emotion towards my mother because my mother stayed with my brother and I. So you have this allegiance. So I can understand. I eventually found my dad very publicly. We've talked about it. I did a book on it. My dad turned out to be, you know, an amazing guy. I obviously knew my dad. I was with him when I was growing up. But I understand the emotion of sort of feeling collegial and like you got to stand by your mom. I felt guilt for a while, Joe.
I think the relationship of the adoptive parents keeping the mother updated on baby Jay, who's only 13 months, will probably continue because that's what they were doing from the day they actually adopted the child. They kept sending her the photos. A lot easier to do again nowadays.
Yes.
Social networking, Instagram.
But that's different. She's talking about in a relationship where it's like cold turkey because, like, in my house, I mean, my parents got a very abrupt divorce. So my dad was no longer around. But you feel this like, okay, well, my mother was the one who kind of took care of us from there. And you feel this like, do I want to go see this other side? What is my dad doing in his life? What's he doing?
But I got to believe that in the case of the 20-year-old who has lost, although she's appealing this,
right,
so this is going to continue to go up the legal ladder, that there is such a missing part of her now.
Well, that's why, you know, in my case, that's why I wanted to reconnect with my dad. My mother, by the way, at the end of her life, wanted me to reconnect with my dad, so that helped too.
But boy, imagine 13 months old, a child probably has no idea. And obviously if a switch were forced upon the situation by the courts where you had to give it back to the natural mother, the birth mother, the child, probably the 13-month-old child, baby Jay, would not have known any difference whatsoever.
Well, that's the difference, too, I think, in this case, because the child is so young and doesn't have all these emotions, whereas an older person, a teenager or whatever, has a better sense.
Let's put it to our listeners here. Who should get the custody of this adopted child? Should it go back to the birth mother or to the adoptive parents who are raising him out of state? 1-800-848-WABC. And as we talk about the battle that occurred between the adoptive parents and the birth mother, where the decision is still in legal limbo, let's go to Pat in Port Jefferson in New York. Welcome to WABC, Pat.
Hi, Pat.
Yes, hello, Pat.
We're having phone problems today, baby. Let's move on.
All kinds. Let's go to Rachel, who's calling from New York. Welcome to Curtis and Rita Cosby here on WABC. Rachel.
Hi, Rachel.
Hi. Hi, guys. How are you?
We're good. We're good. What do you think with the case? Should the birth mom get the baby back?
So as much as I sympathize with this birth mom, being a young mom myself, I feel like this would set a terrible precedent for future teenage pregnancies or even moms that have a baby and then just financially or for some other reason can't raise that baby. It will give them a window to decide that they don't want that child anymore. And I think that's a horrible way to go about this.
I agree.
We need to stick to the laws. People put them in place for a reason. And again, God willing, she'll get to have her chance at having another child.
Well, and also, Rachel, I feel like then it's becoming like baby ping pong, too. It's like, you know, okay, well, now I change my mind. And if you have a little gray, it opens the door.
I must tell you, as much as it is a problem from time to time between adoptive parents and the birth mothers, it is increasingly becoming a problem with pets.
Oh, yeah.
Unwanted pets.
Right, right.
All of a sudden, an adoptive family comes along or an adoptive person. Somebody else says, hey, wait a second. Check the chip that I had implanted in that, in that dog 6 months ago. I had no idea what happened.
And it's a little harder because you think you take a dog in for the good, you know, and don't realize.
But that's my dog. And it has to be adjudicated in court. And both sides will spend, just like in this case, gazillions of dollars out of their pocket.
And then it gets into like the personal and that thing. But I agree with what Rachel was just saying. I think it sets a very dangerous precedent. I think, you know, maybe you expand the window a little more than 72 hours. But I think once someone is so gracious to take in a child and adopt them and treat them as their own, those people are saints.
Well, you said 72 hours. Up next, we're going to have to talk about Andrew Evilize Cuomo, King Cuomo II, the son of Mario Faccia Brutta Cuomo, King Cuomo I. It took him 48 hours to suddenly spew out a different statement about America. Remember, 48 hours ago, he said America wasn't all that great. And now, all of a sudden, he has amended that. You don't want to go anywhere because we're going to ask you if he truly believes what he is saying now. 48 hours later, it took him to change.
And he's still doing the little dance with the verbiage. It's not like I made a mistake. It's that threading of the needle.
You would never expect Cuomo, the pretentious one, to ever admit making a mistake.
But it was so bad. It was so bad.
But let's get our news headlines and updates. Well, in a room in America. 2:39. It was more than 48 hours ago that Andrew Evilize Cuomo, King Cuomo II, the son of Mario Faccia Brutta Cuomo, King Cuomo I, was in front of supporters and those who were seeking his reelection when he said the words that have come back to haunt him.
We're not going to make America great again. It was never that great.
Can I hear that one more time, please, Brian Mangalucci?
We're not going to make America great again. It was never that great.
So yesterday, he continues on in his reelection campaign.
And got pilloried, Curtis. I mean, the whole Democrats were pillorying him. Republicans were pillorying him. The president was saying, it was tweeting out and saying his comments are, quote, career threatening. I mean, even Democrats were saying, you can't say that. You live in America. America bless this country. And it was just a bombardment.
Well, there's no doubt. Remember, he's a political pro, that they started doing focus groups and started doing their own internal polling as soon as he said it.
Well, here's a focus group. You shouldn't have said it. I mean, right away, they didn't even need a focus group to say how bad it was.
He's pretentious. So that means he thinks he knows it all. He has recently said he is the government. Forget the legislative body, the judicial body. As the executive of the state of New York, he is the government.
And no politician ever likes to say, I messed up, and he still sort of hasn't.
So yesterday, he had a spokesperson try to focus on talking about women's rights, civil rights, gays and lesbian rights, and that didn't sail. So today, he decided I better do a conference call with reporters. Now, he didn't go into a room with cameras. He did it over the telephone, mm-hmm. in which reporters would not ask questions. They would just listen and take down the copy. And this is what he said. He did a pirouette. He basically redid what he had said by saying, I want to be very clear to all of you. Of course America is great. And of course America has always been great. My family is evidence of Americans' greatness. And I want to ask all of you in 48 hours, do you think he had an epiphany? Or do you think that Andrew Evilize Cuomo believed what he originally said, that America was never that great to begin with? 1-800-848-WABC. That's 1-800-848-9222.
Now, Curtis, he didn't, and what's so interesting, too, he didn't say, I'm sorry, I misspoke. And as you point out, it took this long to even do sort of a semi-correction. And I call it a semi-correction because the other thing he also said in this call, And what does this say about him? You know, we had Mark Molinaro, who's challenging him, who was on the conservative ticket and also the GOP ticket and the Reform Party ticket, also the nominee for all of those. And he said it says a lot about him that he said it, because at first, right after it happened, he doubled down, basically. And that was his spokesperson in a clear statement. It wasn't like just a brush off, said, yes, he feels that America needs to be greater. It's not that great for women. It's not that great. He kind of danced around it. And now today, here's the latest too in this call. He also said he used an inartful expression as opposed to saying, I didn't mean what I said. I didn't. It's a sort of dance with the language. So, and I think some people are saying, the president included, but some people are saying it's career threatening. I think this line is going to come back to bite him. And if I were Mark Molinaro, I would put it every single campaign ad from here on out.
He did exactly that. He was in studio with us yesterday. In fact, he'll be at the American Legion Post out in Baldwin in Nassau County tonight. One of the many town hall meetings he's doing from Buffalo to Brooklyn. But in this case, it had nothing to do with Andrew Cuomo reassessing, rethinking, having an epiphany. He just understood by his internal polls that this was damaging his reelection effort. So he truly, I know Andrew, I've known him for years. Mm-hmm. He truly believed what he initially said, or the next day he would have amended that.
Or they would have fixed it hours later. He's like, as you say, this is a guy who's, you know, from a political family. He had plenty of time to fix it. And yet his spokesperson came out in a written, remember, came out hours later and said, what he meant when he said it is that America isn't great for women. America, like, he never took it back. They had plenty of time. It's just because he's been bombarded.
Let's go to the phones. First up in the queue is Jimmy, who's calling from Rockland County. Welcome to Curtis and Rita Cosby here on WABC. Jimmy.
Hi, Jimmy.
Yeah, hello, Rita. Hello, Curtis. I don't see what the big deal is, because a lot of people don't think this country is great. Me, personally, I think the country is good. But greatness, I think you reserve that for God or, you know, whoever you believe in.
Well, I think if you're representing the state of New York.
Greatness is in the eye of the beholder.
All right. Well, Jim, let me tell you.
Mm-hmm.
He said America was never that great. So I would venture to say if you're representing the state of New York, you should be a cheerleader.
Let's hear what Jimmy has to say. Go ahead, Jimmy. You got the floor. Go ahead, Jimmy.
Well, he's being honest. It wasn't great for everybody. Do you think it was great during the civil rights when the blacks were being lynched when they first discovered the country, the Native Americans, the land was taken away?
I think Jimmy.
Talking about define greatness.
Jimmy, I think we are far from a perfect country, but I think we're one of the best countries out there and one of the greatest by far. So that makes us great. That, in my mind, we're a great country.
No, you're not, because you're not perfect.
We're not perfect, but we're a lot better than a lot of other places where I have been and where a lot of other of our listeners have been around the world.
I've been in the Army. I did my share. I went to Nam, the whole nine yards.
Jimmy, if you don't like it, if you don't like it, go to some crummy country.
Wait.
Enjoy Nigeria.
Hold on.
You can't scream about how...
Jimmy,
those countries are, and our country is so great.
There are many people who believe what Jimmy believes, that we're a great country but have had a tarnished background.
That's not what Cuomo said.
That's not what he said.
This is opinion, for God's sake.
And he's the governor of New York. He's allowed.
Given his opinion.
Right, but Jimmy, you do agree that he should have stuck to his guns, because that's really what he believes, right?
That's what Jimmy's saying.
He should have.
So guess what? Guess what? He's backtracking. So either he's a political animal, or he wasn't saying the correct thing at first, or it was exactly what he thinks, and now he's changing his mind because of the climate. Either way, Jimmy, if you're representing this state, I don't think we're a perfect country, but we are the best country out there, and I'll say that every day of the week.
But he's entitled to his opinion.
But he's not saying that today.
Doesn't matter. Well, he's doing that because of the political consequences.
That's the point.
But I know Cuomo believes that, and he's not alone.
So then he should stick by his guns.
Well, you know?
that's what I'm saying.
He's not doing that. But let's go to Terry in upstate New York. Welcome to Curtis and Rita Cosby here at WABC. Terry.
He absolutely meant everything he said, and the best way to make New York great again is get every Democrat out of office.
every Democrat and replace them with what? Corrupt Republicans, many of whom have been locked up and sent away to prison? All of a sudden, that stops you.
It's a matter of bad.
Hey, Terry, how about you look at each individual race and you base it upon whether the man or the woman or the other candidates, who they are, and pick the best candidate instead of just blaming the Democrats? Because I can show you jail cells that are filled with Republicans who have been crooked here in New York along with their Democratic colleagues. So you need to go race by race. Get rid of all the Democrats.
I know. See, I mean, you didn't let him talk.
No, because that makes no sense.
Oh, okay. But Terry can talk when I'm in. Right.
No,
yeah, I see the double standard
no,
here,
no,
my friend.
Jimmy in Rockland County was expressing the governor's point of view. And our listeners are entitled to hear what that is since the governor has not expounded upon it.
Let's go to Randy, if we could. Randy, you're here with Curtis and Cosby. Go ahead, Randy.
Hey, good afternoon, guys. Listen, the governor, as a politician, he basically flamed himself. How he could ever run for national office, I just don't see it anymore.
Oh, he can run for national office.
Well, he can run, but he's not going to win. All you have to do is play back America. It was never that great.
I think it will hurt him. I agree, Randy.
The country are going to vote against him.
Well,
and here's the thing.
Let me ask you a question. Did Bernie Altacacas Sanders, a socialist, run for the presidency and almost got the Democratic nomination?
Okay, but you know what? He almost got the Democratic nomination and didn't.
Wasn't he saying a lot of the same things?
No, look, I'm a progressive. I have very critical things to say about our country, but that doesn't mean our country has not been great and isn't great currently. You can be flawed but great. Great does not mean perfect. Martin Luther King Jr., who is undisputably one of the greatest Americans that has ever lived, was an adulterer and had some homophobic tendencies. He's still a great man. He's flawed, but great.
Randy,
I
agree with you. I agree with you. But the problem is going to be right now is also that he's flipping and flopping. Either if that is what he sincerely believes, and that's what they doubled down on right after he said it, he should have stuck to his guns to try, if he's trying to appeal, as Cynthia Nixon has said, to that progressive base, he should have stayed with it.
Well,
he didn't, now he's flipping.
Let's go to RC in Brooklyn. Welcome to Curtis and Rita Cosby here, RC.
Hi, RC.
Hey Curtis. Rita, how you doing? Listen, I think I kind of understand what the governor said, you know?
How so?
Even though he didn't retract his statement. Look, Trump is never retracting anything. He has never, ever said that he said anything wrong. And let me tell you something. I'm 78 years old. I'm a black man from the South. And I've been around the block a few times, you know? So I certainly understand exactly what he said.
Well, that's why, and listen, by the way, RC, I don't think we by any means are a perfect country. We definitely have some bad things in our past. But this flipping and flopping and the whole thing, and politicians don't ever like to say, I'm sorry, or I didn't mean that. But now to say an artful, and he waits 42 hours, I think both parts of it are really damaging
now,
to him.
Now, RC, would you have respected Cuomo more if he just stood to his guns? He just kept the same sentiments?
Listen, to me, it doesn't make a difference. He said what he said, and I understand exactly what he's saying. That's my view.
All right. Do appreciate that.
Yeah, thank you.
1-800-848-WABC. Cuomo now says he made an inartful remark. Of course, America is great. Let's go to Joe in Bayside here at WABC. Welcome, Joe.
Hi, Joe.
Hi, Curtis. Hi, Rita. Listen. I'll cut the guy some slack because I think I understood the context he was saying in. But Trump, he says garbage every day and his surrogates come out and explain, well, that's not what he meant. And he doesn't stop doing it. Helsinki, what did he do? He took sides against America and supported Putin. Then the next day, wouldn't.
We're talking about Cuomo, first of all, and second of all, listen, but you hit a point that most politicians do not like to apologize. You're right about that.
Trump can say it and get away with it. I don't think it's going to hurt Cuomo that much. At least the guy came out and apologize and say I made a mistake.
Well, he
actually didn't.
I will bet you, Joe, that they have factored in the fact that 48 hours took place. They didn't respond. They're now responding now, notice, on a Friday.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Right before the end of the day.
And he didn't say, I'm sorry, Curtis, too. Like, if you look at, you were, like, as you were just saying, he said, it's an artful,
well,
an inartful.
Let's face it. Two boys from Queens grew up a few blocks away from one another. One there in Hollywood.
And now they're back and forth. They're having like
Jamaica
a battle.
States.
Right. There's
neither
a battle of egos.
Them, neither Trump nor Cuomo ever apologized because they share one thing in common. They are pretentious. They think they know everything.